Bienvenue ici à McGill pour ce colloque de M. Colum Tobin. Il me fait grand plaisir de vous voir si nombreux, si nombreuses. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Marguerite Delaurier. I'm the director of the McGill Institute for Gender, Sexuality and Feminist Studies, l'Institut Genre, Sexualité et Féminisme. The institute, I'll just tell you because we're very new, is a unit in the Faculty of Arts with teaching programs, research groups, and a commitment to engage with communities beyond McGill. And that's one reason we're extremely happy to see such a varied audience here today. It's my happy task to welcome you all to this lecture by Colum Tobin, organized jointly by the Institute and the Department of English. So I want to thank my colleagues in English, especially Peter Zabor, the chair, and Alan Hepburn, who you'll meet in a minute, for working with us on this event. And I want to emphasize how much the Institute values its collaborations with other units. We also, of course, have to thank the Beattie Memorial Lectures Committee for funding the event, a crucial part of this. You may be aware that yesterday and this morning, all flights out of New York, where Colum Tobin is now living, were canceled. And so we were in some danger of having to cancel the event. But the administrative staff of the Institute went online, started tracking weather, checking train schedules, calling people, and eventually, with remarkable skill, were able to find a way for Colum Tobin to make it to Montreal from New York. So I really want to thank my staff, especially the ones who worked on this, Natalie Amar, Kaylee Woodyard, and Marielle Govan, who are every day intelligent, resourceful, and good-humored, but especially yesterday and today, that's been wonderful. We also, of course, have to especially thank Colum Tobin himself, because not only was he very gracious and willing when I first asked him if he'd be willing to come and talk to us, but yesterday, despite the inconveniences of travel imposed on him by the snow and by our eagerness to have him come, he was entirely good-natured about it, and indeed said to me when I was apologizing about the inconveniences, that at least this way he got to pass through the place where William James had his first heart attack. which I wouldn't have thought was a high point of the Adirondacks, but there you go. Finally, I just have to mention some technical matters, semi-technical matters. So after this, my colleague Alan Hepburn will do the proper academic introduction of Colum Tobin. Then he's graciously agreed to take questions. You may pose those questions. We usually give the first questions to students to encourage the young. And puisque l'Institut a adopté comme pratique, comme politique, passive bilingualism, ce qui ne veut pas dire franglais, mais c'est que vous êtes donc invité à poser des questions, soit en français, soit en anglais. And Colum Tobin tells me that he's very happy to listen to questions en français. If he needs any translation, we will translate for him. But I note that he once wrote that one of the great pleasures in life is correcting other people's French. So some of you who have French as a second language may like to pose the question so we can give him an extra pleasure while he's here. But right now, as I said, my colleague Alan Hepburn, Professor Alan Hepburn from the Department of English, will introduce Colum Tobin to you properly.
In a recent review essay about the poet Tom Gunn, Colum Tobin mentions that in these decades, artists do not seem complete unless they have a double identity. Tobin himself, born in Enniscorthy in 1955, has at least a triple identity. Tobin the traveler, Tobin the novelist, and Tobin the critic. Although he has deep roots in Ireland, Tobin is a bit of a nomad. After completing his degree at University College Dublin, Tobin moved to Barcelona in 1975, just 2 months prior to the death of Franco. He is particularly attentive to the long shadow thrown over Spanish history by the Civil War in the 1930s. In a book review published in 2004, Tobin talks about the generations who lived through Franco's dictatorship. He says, Many people born in the 1950s and 1960s have unfond memories of their father growing grumpier and more silent as the war was mentioned, or having one story which seemed to mask other more dangerous stories told over and over until it came to resemble a bad alibi. The extraordinary claustrophobic story, A Long Winter, set in Spain and included in the collection Mothers and Sons, describes the despair that secrets can generate. An unhappy mother who walks out in a snowstorm, a son who cannot live beyond the silences that envelop his family. Toybien's first novel, The South, and the nonfiction book, Homage to Barcelona, both published in 1990, speak indirectly and directly about his experiences in Spain. When he returned to Ireland in 1978, he worked as a journalist and editor at the magazine McGill. In 1982, he left Ireland again, this time for South America, where he continued writing. Latterly, he has spent time in the United States, teaching at Stanford University, the University of Texas at Austin, and at present, Princeton University. As a novelist, Toybien has been shortlisted twice for the Man Booker Prize, first for The Blackwater Lightship, the 1999 novel, and again for The Master, from 2004. The Master, one of the best novels to be published in English in the last 70 years, in my mind, it assumes its rightful place alongside Elizabeth Bowen's The Heat of the Day, John Banville's The Untouchable, and J.M. Coetzee's Disgrace, is a portrait of Henry James, aging and solitary, thinking back over his life. The Master won the Impact Dublin Literary Award, the prize for Le Meilleur Livre Étranger in France, as well as other accolades. Toybien's most recent novel is Brooklyn, about Eilish Lacey, an Irish woman who crosses the Atlantic in 1951 to take up work at a department store in Brooklyn. Whatever befalls them, Toybien's characters retain their essential mystery, a certain shy privacy. Eilish, watching her boyfriend Tony at a baseball game, thinks, I love this sentence because of the way it unfolds, the idea that he would never see her as she felt that she saw him now came to her as an infinite relief, as a satisfactory solution to things. Eilish prefers not to be known, or to be known completely, certainly not by her mother, who wishes to manipulate her by pretending that Eilish has no life of her own. In Blackwater Lightship, a crotchety grandmother sees a young gay man approaching her house by the sea and wonders about the kind of person he is and what he will become. It was the way he walked or turned, and I wondered what sort of life he was going to have now, what sort of person he could be. These characters move inside zones of feeling and being that are complete in themselves. In an extraordinary scene in The Master, my hair stands on end whenever I think about this scene, Constance Fenimore Wilson's dresses, having been sunk in a lagoon in Venice, rise ghostly and swollen. A gondolier shoves them back under, pushing, prodding, sinking each dress and then moving to another, while Henry James looks on, frozen by conflicted feelings, unable to speak or react. Toybien, as critic, editor, and nonfiction writer, has been more than prolific. His edited collection, The Penguin Book of Irish Fiction from 1999, shows a characteristic modesty. Although selections from Somerville and Ross, James Joyce, Flann O'Brien, Samuel Beckett, and other worthies appear, Toybien himself is not represented. Ireland in Various Guises is the subject of several books, Dubliners from 1990, Bad Blood from 1994, The Guinness Book of Ireland from 1994 as well, and Lady Gregory's Toothbrush from 2002. Toybien's articles in The New Yorker, Brick, The New York Times Book Review, and The London Review of Books are among the most insightful criticism about literature that I know. As in his essays about Hart Crane, Samuel Beckett, Tennessee Williams, and Tom Gunn, he tells us a great deal more than we could ever have discovered for ourselves. It is an immense pleasure and a great honor to welcome Colm Toybien to McGill University today under the auspices of the Institute for Gender, Sexuality, and Feminist Studies to speak about Oscar Wilde in prison. Colm Toybien.
thanks very much for that, and thanks very much for getting me here. It, I didn't know there was a road, you know. And they were even very nice as we were crossing the border and everything. In 1895, in London, the personal became political because an Irish playwright pushed his luck. Oscar Wilde, as the year opened, was the toast of London. He had powerful friends among the intellectual and political and social elite. He was slowly winning immense respect as a playwright and as an artist, having won in the 1880s notoriety as a wit and social butterfly. He could do as he pleased. His plays were written, although I'm not as sure about this as I was, but his plays seemed to have been written quickly and effortlessly. He himself seemed to, or at least he left no signs that they were not. He himself seemed to move in the same spirit between intimate family life and, when he became bored with that, a life in hotels and foreign places. He could mingle among the great and the good and then pleasurably spend time with young men from a different, mostly a lower social class. He could also continue his liaison with the young and beautiful Lord Alfred Douglas, also known as Bosie, whom he had first met 4 years earlier, and try to ignore the protests of Douglas's father, the Marquess of Queensbury, who was sure that his son was being corrupted. He was at the height of his fame and his glory. He must have seemed untouchable. By May, however, he was in prison, abandoned by most of his friends, his reputation destroyed, his name a byword for corruption and evil, the Marquess of Queensbury fully vindicated. Wilde's family life was destroyed. He was declared a bankrupt, and he was about to serve a sentence whose severity was beyond his imagination. In the years that followed, everyone who wrote about him seemed to have known a different facet of him. W.B. Yeats, for example, remembered Wilde the married man towards the end of the 1880s. Quote, he lived in a little house at Chelsea that the architect Godwin had decorated with an elegance that owed something to Whistler. I remember vaguely a white drawing room with Whistler etchings let into white panels and a dining room all white. Chairs, walls, mantelpiece, carpet, except for a diamond-shaped piece of red cloth in the middle of the table under a terracotta statuette. It was perhaps too perfect in its unity. And I remember thinking that the perfect harmony of his life there, with his beautiful wife and his two young children, suggested some deliberate artistic composition. Oscar Wilde's younger son, Vivian, born in 1886, also remembered those years when his father was, quote, a real companion, unquote, to himself and his brother, with, quote, so much of the child in his own nature that he delighted in playing our games. When he grew tired of playing, he would keep us quiet by telling us fairy stories or tales of adventure of which he had a never-ending supply. Among the writers for children whom Wilde admired, according to his son, was Robert Louis Stevenson, whose The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde appeared in 1886, the year of Vivian's birth. These were the years, as Carl Miller has written in his book Doubles, when, quote, a hunger for pseudonyms, masks, new identities, new conceptions of human nature declared itself. Thus Dr. Jekyll could announce with full conviction, this too was myself, as he became, quote, a stranger in his own house. Jekyll, quote, learned to recognize the thorough and primitive duality of man. I saw that of the two natures that contended in the field of my consciousness, even if I could rightly be said to be either, it was only because I was radically both. Thus as Wilde set to work on the creation of both himself and his character Dorian Gray, he was following an example which was embedded in the spirit of the age. London, in the years around the publication of Wilde's novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, in 1891, was the site where many artists, including W.B. Yeats, George Bernard Shaw, Joseph Conrad, and Henry James, allowed their doubled selves, their work full of masked selves, secret agents, secret sharers, and sexual secrets, to flourish and further duplicate. Wilde in London was both an Englishman and an Irishman, an aristocrat and an Irish patriot, a family man and a man who never seemed to be at home, a dilettante and a dedicated artist. Everywhere he went, he left behind in some attic of the mind an opposite self, recently discarded. Every man, W.B. Yeats pointed out in these same years, has, quote, someone seen, someone adventure, someone picture that is the image of his secret life. In 1909, Joseph Conrad wrote his story, The Secret Sharer, in which the captain of a ship is confronted with his precise double. It was in the night, as though I had been faced by my own reflection in the depths of a somber and immense mirror. Conrad's narrator refers to the interloper as my second self. No self in these years was stable. Robert Louis Stevenson wrote, I am a fictitious article and have long known it. I am read by journalists, by my fellow novelists, and by boys. In August 1891, as he stayed at the Marine Hotel in Kingstown, which is now called Dunleary in Ireland, Henry James, described by his biographer, Leonard Dell, who's of this parish, as someone who was in search of or in flight from something or other, had the idea for his story, The Private Life, in which the sociable writer in the drawing room could at the same moment be found alone with his other self in his study. In these years, the writer was either two people or he was nobody. Henry James, feared and envied Oscar Wilde. He feared Wilde's Irishness while seeking to disguise the fact that his own four grandparents were of Irish origin or Irish birth. He feared Wilde's homosexuality while seeking at times to annihilate his own. He envied Wilde's sociability while seeking further and further solitude. And he envied Wilde's audience while bemoaning the dwindling of the income from his own work. In February 1895, when James's theatrical disaster, Guy Domville, was taken off and replaced by Wilde's new play, The Importance of Being Earnest, James wrote to his brother, Oscar Wilde's farce, which followed Guy Domville, is, I believe, a great success. And with his two roaring successes running now at once, he must be raking in the profits. Wilde's wealth, however, resided in the attic of James's imagination. In the real world, or in the world which seemed real sometimes, Wilde was actually on the run from his creditors. I'm already, sir, with writs for £400, rumours of prosperity having reached the commercial classes. Suddenly, he'd managed to be rich and poor at the same time. Wilde, Declan Kybert had written, was the first major artist to discredit the romantic idea of sincerity and to replace it with the darker imperative of authenticity. He saw that if being true to a single self, a sincere man may be false to half a dozen other selves. This may seem accurate in retrospect, if we view Wilde's career as seamless, planned, and fully imagined, as though it were a story or a work of art. If we view him in the few months before he went to prison, however, as he might have seemed to his contemporaries, or indeed to himself, his life and his work appear rather more accidental and contradictory, dictated both by forces and feelings beyond his control and impelled by a set of actions and decisions which might easily have been different. It must not be forgotten, George Bernard Shaw, who knew Wilde in the years of his fame as a playwright, wrote in 1938, that though by culture Wilde was a citizen of all civilized capitals, he was at root a very Irishman, and as much a foreigner everywhere but in Ireland. Wilde's Irish background remains an essential ingredient in his career, just like Stevenson's Scottishness, Henry James' New England origins, and Conrad's Polish birth. Like his homosexuality, Wilde's Irishness left him an outsider in Oxford and London, but much of the time invisibly and ambiguously so. The English upper classes that he wrote about in his fiction and his plays was, as Carl Miller writes, a class exoticized, eroticized by an outsider. Henry James shared his fascination with the manners and mores of this class. All of these writers shared one essential ingredient with the English in whose country they had settled, a command of the English language. And this operated as a sort of alibi for them, allow them to shine on the page and the stage, allow them immense possibilities for invention and disguise. The voyage from one self to another gave them their style. Their style in turn offered them an easy intercourse with the English themselves. the problem lay in the middle. Oscar Wilde's parents were also steeped in ambiguities. They were members of an Irish ruling class who had offered, through his father's work as an antiquarian and his mother's nationalism and poetry, their allegiance both to an Ireland of the past, before the English invasion, and to an Ireland of the future, which would be free of England. They belonged to a distinguished group of Irish Protestant aristocrats and Bohemians who managed to remain a ruling class in Ireland and an amusing class in London while seeking directly or indirectly the destruction of English power in Ireland. This set of configured and ambiguous allegiances gave the members of this class enormous freedom and helped to sharpen their wit. They were capable of masquerading as eminent Victorians while having rich sexual lives, just as they were capable of managing their estates and servants and having their rents paid on time while preaching freedom. Thus, Lady Gregory, a leading member in the Irish Revival and a founder of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin, born in 1852, could begin her affair with the English poet Wilfred Scawen Blunt a year after her marriage, while modelling her sartorial style on that of Queen Victoria. She could write seditious plays about Ireland while threatening her Irish tenants if they did not pay the rent. Thus, W.B. Yeats, born in 1865, could write poems about unrequited love while pursuing an adventurous and quite exciting love life in London. So too, the parents of Oscar Wilde, Sir William, born in 1815, and Lady Wilde in 1826, could combine sexual license with a knighthood and membership of the Dublin ruling class. So too, Oscar Wilde's mother could write editorials in nationalist newspapers calling for violent revolt against England, and then happily move her salon to London on the death of her husband in 1876. Oscar Wilde, born in 1854, loved referring to his mother as Lady Wilde. Once he arrived in Oxford in his early 20s, he would have seemed a normal member of the upper classes. And indeed, from priggish letters written during these years and from friendships with figures such as George Curzon, Lord Curzon, the future conservative politician and viceroy of India, it's clear that he bore all the hallmarks of his class with pride and skill. His Irish identity was uncertain. This very uncertainty meant that he could, while in England, insist on his own Irishness, as though for the first time, while learning to mimic his new friend's Englishness. His heritage, unlike that of his English friends, however, was based on no firm set of morals and manners, no long-held convictions about privileges and rules. His heritage was protean and open to suggestion. He looked like the English ruling class. He could speak like them if it suited him. He enjoyed their company and he entertained them. But as a writer, what he learned to do best was mock them. When it came to the crisis, he would fundamentally misunderstand them. His homosexuality, like his Irishness, would also loosen his allegiances to shared principles, would assist further in undermining his loyalty to any set of values held by those who made the laws and those who obeyed them. Ford Madox Ford, who at one point used the same lawyer as Wilde, knew about Wilde's chameleon qualities and admired his ability when the crisis came to exude self-pity in enormous quantities, while at the same time being able to see his own self-pity as a kind of play or further self-dramatization. Ford wrote, "There came a dramatic moment in the lawyer's office. Wilde began to lament his wasted life. He uttered a tremendous diatribe about his great talents thrown away, his brilliant genius dragged in the mud, his early and glorious aspirations come to nothing. He became almost epic. Then he covered his face and wept. His whole body was shaken by his sobs. Humphreys, his lawyer, was extremely moved. He tried to find consolation. Wilde took his hands down from his face. He winked at Humphreys and exclaimed triumphantly, 'Got you then, old fellow.'" In the same article, written in 1939, Ford remembered the visits of Oscar Wilde to his grandfather, Ford Madox Brown. Wilde once more arrived as one of his own doubles. "Mr. Wilde was a quiet individual," Ford wrote, "who came every Saturday for years to tea with the writer's grandfather, Ford Madox Brown. Wildwood sit on the high-backed armchair, stretching out one hand a little towards the blaze of the wood fire on the hearth, and talking of the dullest things possible to Ford Madox Brown, who sat on the other side of the fire in another high-backed chair and stretching out towards the flames his other hand, disagreed usually with Mr. Wilde on subjects like that of Home Rule for Ireland Bill or the conversion of the consolidated debt. Wilde, Ford wrote, continued these visits, as he said later, out of liking for the only house in London where he did not have to stand on his head. All of these dualities clearly inspired the wit, the perfect patterning and the pure subversion in his best criticism and his best work for the theatre. They do not, however, help to explain the sheer badness of his poetry, which is full of pre-Raphaelite gloom, archaic phrasing, sentiments he did not mean, and rarefied poetic diction. His dualities came in many guises then. He was not only a married man who was homosexual and an Irishman in London, a wit who was also serious, a limp and timid lyricist, but he was also a limp and timid lyricist who wrote brave and modern plays. None of these dualities, however, either caused or can fully explain his frame of mind and what happened to him in the winter and spring of 1895. On the 3rd of January of that year, his play An Ideal Husband opened at the Haymarket Theatre in London to critical acclaim and great popularity. The Prince of Wales and the future Prime Minister Balfour were in attendance on the opening night, although perhaps that's not so strange. There seems to be nothing they both weren't at that time. Nonetheless, it's worthy of just showing in. The Importance of Being Earnest was already written and was set to replace Henry James's failed play Guy d'Anville at the St. James's Theatre on the 14th of February. At the beginning of January, Wilde was persuaded by his lover, Lord Alfred Douglas, to accompany him to Algeria, although he in fact wished to oversee the rehearsals of his new play. As André Gide, who, believe it or not, actually met them in Algiers, attested, their time in Algeria was interesting. All three of them found a pleasure and freedom not as easily or cheaply available in London or Paris. The reputation of Wilde and Douglas came before them. Gide wrote to his mother that Wilde was the most dangerous product of modern civilization. He seemed to Gide to have corrupted Douglas to the very marrow of his bone. Wilde set about corrupting Gide too, or so Gide wrote much later, introducing him. This is introducing Gide in Algiers to an Arab boy and accompanying them to an apartment where Gide held, this is not me writing now, this is Gide writing, in his bare arms, that perfect wild little body, so dark, so ardent, so lascivious. Later, as Gide told his mother, by the way, he left out the part in the letter to the mother about the Arab boy, they met up with Douglas, who had a boy called Ali in tow, who must have been 12 or 13, according to Gide, although Douglas, quote, returned incessantly and with disgusting obstinacy to things I spoke of with only the greatest embarrassment, an embarrassment that was increased by his total lack of it. Gide admitted that he found Douglas absolutely charming. Wilde wrote to his friend Robert Ross about the beauty in Algeria, the lovely boys and the joys of hashish. Quote, we have been on an excursion into the mountains of Kabylia, full of villages peopled by fawns. Several shepherds fluted on reeds for us. We were followed by lovely brown things from forest to forest. The beggars here have profiles, so the problem of poverty is easily solved. Sorry, this is wild. It has nothing to do with me, I promise. It is likely that excitement they found in Algeria, while wonderful perhaps in its way, was also deeply unsettling, making English rules and responsibilities seem even more absurd and worth ignoring. Wilde returned to London at the end of January. The incoming ferry was 20 hours late because of a storm. The outgoing journey was also rough. From Marseille, Wilde travelled to Paris, where he visited Degas, and then went to London and to attend final rehearsals and prepare for his opening night. In the shadows always was his family, whom he did not see. His sons were at boarding school, but he stayed in hotels in any case, while his wife remained uncertain of his whereabouts. And Lord Alfred Douglas's father, the Marquess of Queensberry, who wished to sever the connection between Wilde and his son. Wilde was anchorless, rudderless, and more famous. He dined out and stayed out late. There is no evidence that he read quietly in his hotel room. He was not producing any new work, and letters written during this time are brief and hurried. When The Importance of Being Earnest opened, the New York Times wrote, "Oscar Wilde may be said to have at last, and by a single stroke, put his enemies under his feet." But it was not true. His enemies lay within, among the warring factions of his unsettled self, and outside himself, too, as the Marquess of Queensberry became more and more determined to save his son. The Marquess of Queensberry had bought a ticket for the opening night of Wilde's play. On the 14th of February, Wilde wrote to an unidentified correspondent, "Bosie's father is going to make a scene tonight. I'm going to stop him." A few days after the opening, he wrote to Lord Alfred Douglas that the Scarlet Marquess made a plot to address the first night of my play. He was not allowed to enter. He left a grotesque bouquet of vegetables for me. This, of course, makes his conduct, this is still Wilde, his conduct idiotic, robs it of dignity. He arrived with a prize fighter at all Scotland Yard, 20 police to guard the theatre. He prowled around for 3 hours, then left chattering like a monstrous ape. And there were other enemies, too, in the city where Wilde had reinvented himself. The young men, less rich and privileged than he, who at this time he still considered his friends and whom he entertained lavishly. They would soon prove ready to blackmail him and inform the Marquess of Queensberry about his activities. It cannot be overestimated how much raw fame was attached to the author of two successful new plays running at the same time in London in these years. Nor can it be overemphasized how Wilde's highly charged time in Algeria and the travelling there and back had further damaged his equilibrium. 100 years later, his behavior would have been perfectly understood as deriving from a mixture of jet lag and crazed celebrity. In 1895, there were no such understandings nor terms to describe them. Wilde, in any case, was already, when he received the famous card, someone on the run. Someone whose judgment on any important matter would have been seriously impaired. The card, left at the Albemarle Club, was dated 18th of February, 4 days after Wilde's second successful opening night, in other words, after the opening of The Importance of Being Earnest. But he did not receive it until 10 days later. It read, "To Oscar Wilde, posing as a sodomite." Sodomite, S-O-M-D-O-M-I-T, and it was from the Marquess of Queensberry. What would the author of Wilde's Decay of Lying or The Importance of Being Earnest have said about this card? How would he have replied? The card had been handed first to the porter at the club, who had held it for the author. Wilde, as he read it carefully, lost all the flippancy and clever carelessness which he paraded in print and on the stage. Instead, he became the son of Sir William Wilde, friend to the most powerful figures in the London of his day, and a distinguished writer whose openings were attended by the Prince of Wales. He was elated and exhausted, bubbling with success and fame. The mask was pulled back. The card did not amuse him or cause him to respond as readers of his work might have expected, with laughter or disdain or mockery or insouciance. The card caused him to adopt a new tone which was pompous and hurt and self-important. His letter to Robert Ross, written on that day, used words like hideous and ruined and terms like criminal prosecution. He ceased to mock the ruling class. He strove now to present himself as an indignant member of it. His swelled head, George Bernard Shaw later wrote, led him to believe that, as he himself put it, there was nothing he could not carry through successfully. A delusion which seems to have taken possession of him when his success as a playwright brought him plenty of money for the first time. The excitement of the previous 2 months, had impaired his judgment. His status as an aristocratic Irishman, to whom London had pandered, would not help him now as he sought to defend his good name. Something about which he had been, both in his actions and his attitudes, extremely careless in the years leading up to 1895. It is his vanity that has brought all this disgrace upon him, his brother Willie told W.B. Yeats. Quote, "They swung incense before him. They swung it before his heart," his brother said. Wilde was one of the very few who did not realize that he was, as the trial began, as he brought a case against the Marquess of Queensberry, the most vulnerable man in London. It is only with the recent publication of the full transcript of the questioning of Wilde by the lawyer Edward Carson in the first case, Wilde's case against the Marquess of Queensberry, that we have an idea of precisely the sort of life that he had been living in the years before his trial, moving between his domestic role, his life as a writer, his social life in clubs and drawing rooms, and the time spent in restaurants and hotels with numerous young men from a lower social position. The transcript gives us a sense of the risks Wilde was taking in bringing the case in the first place. Robert Ross, his friend, advised him at the time not to take a case. Frank Harris, another friend, agreed, "You are sure to lose it," Harris later reported telling him, "You haven't a dog's chance." And the English despised the beaten. When Wilde had lunch with Harris and George Bernard Shaw, he was told by both, "Drop the case. You should go abroad," Harris told him, "and as an ace of trumps, you should take your wife with you." Wilde, George Bernard Shaw, remembering that lunch, wrote in 1938, miscalculated the force of the social vengeance that he was unloosening on himself. Harris claimed that as the lunch came to an end and Oscar seemed inclined to do as I proposed, which was drop the case, Lord Alfred Douglas arrived. Quote, "At Oscar's request, I repeated my argument, and to my astonishment, Douglas got up at once and cried with his little white, venomous, distorted face, 'Such advice shows you are no friend of Oscar's.'" In his preface to Harris's book on Wilde, George Bernard Shaw made clear that neither he nor his associates, including Harris, knew of Wilde's homosexuality as a matter of fact until cross-examination in the case. They knew of his decadence or his flaunting a sort of sexual uncertainty, but they did not know that he was consorting with younger men of the lower social classes, nor that he had actually had sexual relations with Lord Alfred Douglas. When Shaw confirmed Harris's account of the warning given to Wilde at the Café Royal, he insisted that it was on the basis only that a jury would not rule against a father who seemed to be protecting his own son's reputation. Harris's subsequent blaming of Lord Alfred Douglas for forcing Wilde to take the case, and indeed his account of Douglas's physiognomy, deserved to be taken lightly and treated with care. It was easy with hindsight to demonise Douglas. It was Wilde who sued. It was Wilde who chose to stay in London rather than flee to France when he had lost the case against the Marquess of Queensberry, when it became inevitable, because of evidence given in that case, that the Crown would bring a criminal charge against him. There is no simple, clear reason why Wilde remained in London once his libel action against the Marquess collapsed, and it was apparent that, as a result of information offered in that libel action, he would be arrested on charges of gross indecency with enough evidence to convict him. As the time grew near for the decision to be made, when there was still a possibility of catching a train and boat to France, he could not make up his mind. A half-packed suitcase lay on the bed, emblem of contradictory impulses. Wilde's biographer, Richard Ellman, wrote, quote, "He was tired of action. Like Hamlet, as he understood that hero, he wished to distance himself from his plight. To be the spectator of his own tragedy," this is Ellman, "a man so concerned with his image disdained to think of himself as a fugitive, skulking in dark corners instead of lording it in the limelight. Suffering was more becoming than embarrassment." W.B. Yeats remembered that when he called at the house, Yeats called at the Wilde house on the instruction of his father to express solidarity with the Wilde family against Victorian hypocrisy. This is Yeats. Wilde's brother Willie said to him, "If he is acquitted, he will stay out of England for a few years and can gather his friends about him once more. Even if he is condemned, he will purge his offence. But if he runs away, he will lose every friend that he has." Yeats later heard, "From whom I forget now," Yeats wrote, "that Lady Wilde, Oscar Wilde's mother, who was an Irish nationalist, had told Oscar, 'If you stay, even if you go to prison, you will always be my son. It will make no difference to my affection. But if you go, I will never speak to you again.'" Wilde's family, it seems, somehow saw their own destiny as rebels, as belonging to Irish history, in Oscar's martyrdom. They believed their honour was at stake. Quote, "He is an Irish gentleman and he will face the music," his brother said. quote, "I've never doubted," Yeats wrote, "even for an instant, that he made the right decision, and that he owes to that decision half of his renown." For Irish patriots of even the mildest hue, a prison sentence, especially one served in England, was a badge of honour and a cause for celebration. Wilde's brother was wrong, however, when he said that Wilde would lose every friend he had if he absconded. Most of Wilde's friends, including his wife, were English enough to favour his leaving. His refusal to do so was not only prompted by the advice of his mother and brother, or his Irish disrespect for the law, or his prevarication, as Ellman would have it, but also, and perhaps predominantly, by the fact that he had not the slightest idea of what a sentence of 2 years' hard labour would entail. Prison for him was an abstract thing, until after two devastating trials at the Old Bailey, in which young men whom he had trusted gave evidence against him, he was found guilty of, quote, "acts of gross indecency with another male person," and sentenced to 2 years in prison with hard labour. He served these 2 years to the day. Quote, "People not familiar with prisons had no idea what their procedures were," Richard Ellman wrote. This is perhaps the only excuse for Henry James, who wrote to Paul Bourget that Wilde's sentence to hard labour was too severe, that isolation would have been more just. Wilde's misfortune was to serve his sentence just before prison conditions were officially changed by the 1898 Prisons Act. Until that act was passed, isolation in all its rigour was harder than anyone, including Wilde himself or Henry James, imagined. In isolation, Wilde slept on a plank bed with no mattress. The idea of a plank bed was that it was so narrow, the plank up, that every time you fell asleep, you fell off. He was allowed 1 hour's exercise a day, walking in Indian file in the yard with other prisoners, but not allowed to communicate with them. He could not sleep, he was permanently hungry, and he suffered from dysentery. The food, as far as he could work out, was designed to cause dysentery. From the first month, he was tied to the treadmill 6 hours a day, making an ascent of it, as it were. In other words, his pushing was the same as pushing upwards, of 6,000 feet each day, with 5 minutes rest after every 20 minutes. Towards the end of his sentence, when the regime had eased somewhat because of a change of warden at the jail, the prison governor remarked to Robert Ross, quote, "He looks well, but like all men unused to manual labour who receive a sentence of this kind, he will be dead within 2 years." In the outside world, Constance Wilde planned to take the children to Ireland. But as Vivian recalled, the hue and cry after the Wilde family was just as bad, if not worse, in Ireland, the land of my father's birth. So our plans were changed. It was thought better, after all, that we should go and hide ourselves abroad, and they went to Switzerland. There, at least, we could live unmolested. My mother remained behind to be of what assistance she could to my father, until she too was driven from her home by the entrance of the bailiff's men and the subsequent sale of all the contents of the house. The sale was a scandalous piece of barefaced robbery. For months afterwards, my brother and I kept asking for our soldiers, our trains and other toys, and we could not understand why it upset our mother. It was only when I saw the catalogue many years later that I realised why my mother had been so upset. The sale consisted of 246 lots. Number 237 was a large quantity of toys. They realised 30 shillings. Neither Vivian nor his brother ever saw their father again. Lady Wilde, the boy's grandmother, Oscar Wilde's mother, would die during the first year of her son's imprisonment, and she'd be buried in a pauper's grave. Constance would die within a year of his release. In the meantime, Lord Alfred Douglas was in France, feeling as sorry for himself as he did for Wilde, with no understanding of what a sentence of 2 years' hard labour would be like. Wilde's prison sentence was bound to change his relationship with Lord Alfred Douglas. The affair between them, which had transformed both of their lives, had always been tempestuous. While their arguments and Lord Alfred Douglas's tantrums, such as they are well documented, their ordinary life together, their fierce attachment to each other, and their love for each other must be most of the time taken for granted. In fact, there's a subsequent letter when Wilde's out of prison where Wilde's talking about the cover for one of his books and just mentions in passing that Lord Alfred thinks it should be this or that. And it's the only reference you get in any of the correspondence of them having a sort of time together where they could discuss ordinary things. But you, so you just have to read that as there and read that it wasn't remarkable, it was daily, and whereas the tantrums were really what was worthy of comment. In April and May 1895, however, before he went to prison, Wilde had made his love for Douglas absolutely clear to his friends and in a series of letters. He wrote to his friends Moore, Ady, and Robert Ross, "Bosie is so wonderful. I think of nothing else. I saw him yesterday." A week later, he wrote that nothing but Alfred Douglas's daily visits quickens me into life. Douglas, in turn, wrote to him from Paris, "I continue to think of you day and night and send you all my love. I'm always your own loving and devoted boy." Before he was sentenced, Wilde wrote two last passionate and tender letters to Douglas, in which he said that never has anyone in my life been dearer than you. Never has any love been greater, more sacred, more beautiful. And, oh, sweetest of all boys, most loved of all loved, my soul clings to your soul, my life is your life, and in all the world of pain and pleasure, you are my ideal of admiration and joy. He did not, indeed could not, was not allowed, write to him again for 19 months. And it was during this time he began to rethink what had happened between them. The next letter is called De Profundis. The writing of De Profundis during the final months of Wilde's sentence was only possible because of the gradual relaxation in the severity of the prison regime, beginning in July 1896 with the arrival of Major J. O. Nelson as warden of Reading Jail. Wilde was later to praise Nelson as the most Christ-like man I ever met. Under the previous regime, Wilde had been allowed to write letters to solicitors and the Home Office, or in limited quantities to friends, but his letters were inspected and the writing materials removed as he finished. Now he was to be allowed pen and ink all the time. And while what he wrote was removed each evening, it was handed back to him the next morning. Because De Profundis was in the form of a long letter, which was a clever stratagem devised by him and agreed to by Nelson, then it would be his property. The idea was, Wilde is writing allowed to write letters. This is a letter. Therefore, even if it's long, he must be allowed to finish it. It took him 3 months with much revision. By this time, his love for Douglas had turned into a sort of bitterness, and the tone of his long letter manages to capture that bitterness, as well as the extraordinary attachment he felt for Douglas. De Profundis is neither fair-minded nor consistent. It is at times greatly bloated in its comparisons and its rhetoric. But there is also much of the time in the prose a beautiful calm eloquence. The balance comes in the way the sentences are constructed, rather than in the quality of the humility or the accusations. There's a sense of urgency, of matters newly realized being said, because there might not be time or opportunity to say them in the future. Wilde's old skill at paradox and phrase-making was no longer there to amuse his audience or mock his betters, but to kill his own pain and grief. He wrote not as art now, but as desperately serious matter. The only beautiful things, his character Vivian told us in The Decay of Lying, are the things that do not concern us. 7 years later, in his Cry from the Depths, he wrote of what most deeply concerned him. Quote, "If there be one single passage that brings tears to the eyes, weep as we weep in prison, when the day no less than the night is set apart for tears." And then it's what is perhaps the most shocking sentence in the whole letter he wrote. "The supreme vice is shallowness. Once upon a time, it would have been the supreme virtue." He accused Douglas of distracting him from his art, of spending his money, of degrading him ethically, of a constant scene-making, of deliberately and then thoughtlessly mistreating him. He went over Douglas's bad behaviour in matters large and petty, always adding dates and places and details, but working on a tone which was fluent and sweeping, full of carefully controlled emotional cadence and measured elegance. The change in his voice was astonishing. It was like a tenor becoming a baritone. The new range and depth and new attention to feeling, the old skills and tricks with pitch and paradox were still in place, despite his circumstances, and perhaps because of them. The letter cannot be read for its accurate account of their relationship, nor taken at his word. While some of the accusations are true, others are petty and foolish and untrue. But that is not the point. It was not written by an historian attempting to set the record straight. Nor can it be read as Wilde's poems can be read, as efforts at the creation of a purely beautiful music. De Profundis has neither the informality of a personal letter, nor the art of a piece of imaginative writing. Its seductive, hurt, and passionate tone places it in a different category. Deborah Fundus remains Wilde's greatest piece of prose writing because of the change which has come over his imaginative procedures. The high priest of flippancy and mocking laughter has set himself suddenly and shockingly against shallowness. He is desperately hurt and wounded. But he is still in command of his sentences, their structure and their sweep. In the dim light of the prison cell, with the memory of his suffering fresh, it was as though he sought a new sort of tension between breathlessness and breath control in his writing. He wrote long and highly wrought sentences, loving lists of adjectives and clever Latinate diction and elaborate punctuation, to be followed by a pure, plain statement full of the clipped, sharp tone of the Anglo-Saxon. "Of course I should have got rid of you," he wrote. The reader will want to know why he did not, and the answer comes in the length and the complexity of Wilde's relationship with Douglas, in the very intimate and immediate tone of Deborah Fundus itself, in the letters written to Douglas in May 1895, and the fact that both of them, once Wilde was released, made an effort to live together and stay together, to the horror of both Constance Wilde and Douglas's family. Deborah Fundus then, despite everything, is a sort of love letter, even though it might not have been meant like that, nor indeed been greatly welcomed by his recipient at the time. Wilde's problem on his release was close to his problem on being arrested. The general lack of understanding of what such a prison sentence would be like, what damage it would cause. Some of his friends presumed that he would begin writing again, not realizing that something essential in him had been broken. In June 1897, he wrote to Frank Harris, "The prisoner looks to liberty as an immediate return to all his ancient energy, quickened into more vital forces by long disuse. When he goes out, he finds he still has to suffer. His punishment, as far as its effects go, lasts intellectually and physically, just as it lasts socially. He still has to pay." In The Decay of Lying, he had criticized the writer Charles Reed for a foolish attempt to be modern, to draw public opinion to the state of our convict prisons through his novels written with a social conscience. Now he himself, in two long and eloquent letters to the Daily Chronicle, made clear the level of cruelty exercised in the prison system, what he had witnessed and what he had personally suffered. In his exile, he became the thing he would have most despised a few years earlier, a social reformer. In June 1897, soon after his release, he also began work on the Ballad of Reading Gaol. On the 22nd of August, he wrote to Lawrence Housman, "I am occupied in finishing a poem terribly realistic for me and drawn from actual experience, a sort of denial of my own philosophy of art in many ways. I hope it is good, but every night I hear cocks crowing, so I'm afraid I may have denied myself, and I would weep bitterly if I had not wept away all my tears." Both Yeats and Richard Ellman preferred the poem when it told its story directly and dealt with a specific narrative. Yeats cut out the more abstract sections in his Oxford Book of Modern Verse. The ballad, Ellman wrote, is strongest when it concentrates on the trooper and prison conditions, weakest when it deals with capitalized abstractions like sin and death, and imports imagery from the rhyme of the ancient mariner. At its best, the sharp details and colloquial language carry conviction. Yeats himself made many well-wrought poems with a single tone and a sharp finish. His style as a poet, even when he was at his most lyrical, was decisive and definitive. Wilde managed such a tone in The Importance of Being Earnest, with seamless patterning and no room for untidy diversions or parts of the plotting which were less than perfect. It was almost unimaginable, however, that he could have produced such a work in the summer of 1897. He had previously written poems with elaborate verse and rhyme schemes, and he was, as the plots of his plays show, a great magpie with the work of other writers, to which he added an enormous fluency of his own. I mean, he stole plots, usually. Kipling's Barrack Room Ballads had appeared to great popularity in 1892. Now Wilde chose the popular ballad as his form, six-line stanzas, with the last line often coming in a more startling and flat rhythm than the rolling rhythms of the previous five. The poem has none of the self-pity of Deborah Fundus. There is instead a tone of terror which comes in some of the stanza endings and then not in others. The variety in the narrative, moving from stanzas about the general plight of the condemned to the specific story of one man who is to be executed and back again, offers the poem moments of pure shock, which would not be there were the poem more singly focused. Wilde himself realized that it was not a perfect work of art. He wrote to Robert Ross in October 1897 about his misgivings. The poem suffers under the difficulty of a divided aim in style. Some is realistic, some is romantic, some poetry, some propaganda. I feel it keenly, but as a whole, I think the production is interesting. The poem was published in February 1898 under Wilde's Reading prison number, C33. But the seventh edition in 1899 had his name in brackets under the number. The first six editions sold 5,000 copies in England within 3 months of publication. In 1954, when Vivian Holland, because they had to change the name of the family, Constance Wilde changed the name of the family to Holland, so that Wilde's grandson, who's still alive, is still called Merlin Holland. As he was called after his father's disgrace when the family fled to the continent, wrote his memoir, Son of Oscar Wilde. He remarked that he did not see a copy of the poem until he went to Cambridge in 1905. Until then, he had not even known of its existence. I do not think my mother ever saw it at all. The conspiracy of silence around my father was very efficient, and I doubt whether anyone would have called her attention to it. But he was mistaken. Constance Wilde merely kept it hidden from her children. On 19th of February, 1898, Constance wrote to her brother, I'm frightfully upset by this wonderful poem of Oscar's. It's frightfully tragic and makes one cry. A month before she died, she wrote about the poem again to her friend Carlos Blacker. If you do see Oscar, tell him I think the ballad exquisite. I hope that the great success it has had in London will urge on him to write more. Wilde himself died 2 years later in November 1900. The Ballad of Reading Gaol was his last work. Had Wilde died peacefully in his bed in the opening months of 1895, and fallen out of the boat on the way to or from Algeria, before bringing a case against Lord Alfred Douglas's father, before serving his sentence, he would still be a great playwright. His work, especially The Importance of Being Earnest, would be as central in our repertoire as it is now. The man who suffered would not have come to light. The mind which created and the art he made would have been everything. What happened to him over the next 5 years has changed our response to his work, however. His name became a byword for martyrdom, for the fall from grace, for the gap between the salon and the prison cell, which made him seem both so narrow, which he made seem so narrow and so wide. His plays would have survived without his notoriety. And yet, when we watch them, we cannot erase the knowledge that such cleverness led to prison. We hold our breath at his cheek. The laughter he provokes has a dark and unsettling edge. Such cleverness, placed under the pressure of suffering, also led directly to Wilde's greatest poem and one of the greatest ballads written in the language, the Ballad of Reading Gaol. And it also led to the astonishing and enticing cadences of De Profundis and the reforming, steely eloquence of his letters to the Daily Chronicle, letting the wider world know what the narrow world of the prison did to its inmates. The man who had reveled in duality became in those writings quite singular, and all the more interesting and intriguing for that. He moved from being a writer of the 1890s to becoming our contemporary by adding in his work from prison new, strange, and deeply affecting aspects to his old duality, a new mask which came to look more like a face than any which he'd worn before. If anyone has any, I mean, I, I don't know if I actually know any more than that, but if anyone if anyone does, please, perhaps you could hear about it. Does anyone have anything?
If there, I know there are two classes of students here, and the suggestion would be they might like to begin. Yeah? Sorry, I saw a hand over there. Go ahead.
Can I just ask you to turn on your mic before you speak? Thanks.
Sorry, I'm not in the class, but I would like to ask a question. I'm not going to speak in French, but you can correct my Irish if I say felce. Is that correct?
Oh yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering, when and to what extent did the Republic of Ireland modify its laws against homosexuality?
Did everybody hear that question? What happened was that in 1922, when what was called the Irish Free State got independence, I suppose, like Canada and Australia, it held on statute books the full body of English case law. In other words, it didn't suddenly start from scratch with no laws. So every law was on, including the Victorian laws against homosexuality. And they then remained on the statute books. Sometime in the 1960s, probably something like 68, there were simply no further prosecutions. But the laws remained on the statute books. And this was a situation which suited everybody. It was, you know, hypocrisy at work, really. You know, it was effective hypocrisy. They didn't do as the British did, commissioner report, which is a very British way of doing things. Commissioner report, you read the report and pass legislation accordingly. They simply, and also you don't get the same blackmail's charter in Ireland as in England. There's not as much evidence of people being blackmailed, and there's also evidence that the more you look, the more you find, in fact, of a serious culture. I even hesitate to say subculture of homosexuality, in Dublin throughout these years. For example, the Gate Theatre for half the year was run by Micheál MacLearmore and Hilton Edwards, who clearly and openly lived together, were clearly and openly gay. And in fact, when Micheál MacLearmore died, the president of Ireland, Patrick Hillary, this would be in the 1970s, and with the law still in place, you know, the president of Ireland, Patrick Hillary, attended his funeral and shook the hand of Hilton Edwards and said what you say to the widow at an Irish funeral, I'm sorry for your trouble. And that there was, so that within the acting community, there was a whole world going on. Obviously, this couldn't continue. So in 1979, a young civil rights lawyer, Mary Robinson, who later would become the president of Ireland, who had brought a number of cases, for example, in those years, women weren't allowed on juries, for example, or contraception, you couldn't sell contraceptives. Mary Robinson brought a number of cases into the Irish Supreme Court, where these rights were then delivered. For example, the entire contraception law was given by a set of Supreme Court judgments, so was women on juries, and there were a good number of other cases of that sort, each one brought to the court by Mary Robinson. Mary Robinson, working with a case from a man called David Norris, who was a lecturer in English in Trinity College Dublin, was a very brave man. He went in and said that his civil rights as an Irish citizen, his bodily integrity, which is a phrase used in the Constitution, and his privacy, a number of other matters which are in articles in the Constitution, were being interfered with by these laws, and he wanted these laws declared unconstitutional. Went into the High Court and lost the case in the High Court. In the Supreme Court, a five-judge court, three judges against, two judges for. I have to say the main judgment given by the Chief Justice, assented to by two other judges, one of whom later became the Chief Justice, is an absolutely disgraceful piece of, I suppose, prejudice. In other words, it's hard to see them working as lawyers. What the state did was it didn't give any evidence. It merely cross-examined very heavily sometimes some of the people who were for Norris. Anyway, they lost 3-2. Mary Robinson took the case to the European Court of Human Rights. In 1988, the European Court of Human Rights instructed the Irish government to to change the law. The Irish government said to the European Court of Human Rights, we don't use the law. You know, it's not a problem for anyone. And the European Court of Human Rights said, go to hell, change the law. You cannot continue with this. And it was a sort of, it was embarrassing. And so in 1989, the government said, let's change the law. They got another instruction from the European Court. The judgment of the European Court of Human Rights are not binding, but they are powerful. And each year, they told them to change the law, and each year they didn't. The reason they didn't was that they just couldn't. They just couldn't talk about things like that in the parliament. And it was embarrassing, and they didn't know anyone like that anyway, except David Norris. If only he had kept himself to himself, no one would have interfered with him. So, you know, it was, oh. And at this time, of course, there are gay discos opening at this time, you know, like it's a, you know. And there was a young minister, new minister for justice, who was in every way very conservative, was from a terribly conservative constituency in the west of Ireland, who had been filled with people who were very conservative, wary Catholics. And she decided, actually, she was going to deal with this. And she pushed the legislation through, and she was going to make the age of consent 21, which was what it was in England at the time, or in the United Kingdom at the time. When the mother of one of the activists went to see her and said, have you got any children of your own? And she suddenly realized she did have a son in that sort of age group. And she said, what are you talking about? So the age of consent was actually 17, and that was done in, I think it was 93. For a while, it was lovely because we were more liberal than England. And it meant that if you're still on the border between, you know, Northern Ireland and the Republic, well, one foot here, that could be 17. And the other one could be 21, you know. And we went around boasting about that for a while. And so that's how all that happened. Oh, and also I just should add that with the full support of the Catholic Church, oddly enough, they put in anti-discrimination in the workplace and anti-incitement to hatred. That those two pieces of legislation were also put in, but they're very difficult to use. And I don't think either of them has really been effectively used. In Ireland.
Yeah. This may seem a little off track, but having you here, I feel extremely grateful to be able to speak to you. Actually, I wanted to ask about a piece that you did in 2008. Do you remember an artist, Mike Alexier, that asked you to do a piece for a school outside of Toronto? And actually, I was one of those students that worked with him. And your story.
What word did you get?
I believe every. And I just wanted to, on behalf of my class, thank you for doing that for us. And actually ask you, I've been wondering for years now, how you decided to write that story about Malik for us, and whether you got to see the end project of that.
This is where it was such a funny request that you sort of thought, this is either very mad or very sane. It was to do 1,334 words, and each student got a word to write out in handwriting. And then the artist, Mike Alexier, would collate all the words, and some people would put big dots on their eyes, and some people wrote big, and others small, and others were quite illegible, actually, a few. And that he put them all in lines, so you could actually read the story, but each word had been written by an individual student in your school, year or every. But, so the problem was what to write. You know, I thought, oh my God, what will we do? And I had been thinking for a while about the whole, especially in Europe now, well, actually mainly in Europe now, the whole depiction of the Arab, Pakistanis, or people of Arab persuasion in Europe, are being judged in a way that maybe the Irish in England were at one point, as being potential terrorists. If they're not terrorists now, they will be. Or they're harbouring them, or they're thinking about being that. And, I mean, it really comes up quite seriously, even in debates, you know, and quite serious people who are liberal in other ways think that the Arab community in, say, Amsterdam or in Holland or in France, that there has to be constant vigilance of these people, that they're, you know, that they can't wear certain clothes, or that they can't, you know. Anyway, so I realized that there was a whole community in Barcelona, and I started to study them. I'd walk up down the street, look at them, and try and imagine that I was one of them. I'm trying to think what I'd really like, and I thought what I'd really like is some money, a new DVD machine, new music. I'd like to go home. I'd like shorter hours work. I'd like a room of my own. So I thought all those things are just normal things that people want when they're away from home, and things they miss. And so I started to think about that. And this guy, Malik, turns up, and he's really young, and he's... I tried to think, what would it be like if someone sent me off to Barcelona without a word of the language to be a barber in a shop? The first thing I thought was, I'd be the worst barber imaginable, and you know that machine they put in the back of your head to... I wouldn't know how to use that, and no matter how much they'd show me, I'd be... I can't even change a plug or a light bulb or anything. And that I would be really bad at it, and I'd be tufts of hair in the wrong place and stuff. And... So what he does is he finds a friend called Super, who the guy who owns the barbershop is called Baldy, and the guy who I know, and the guy who owns the supermarket is called Super. But one day he's in the supermarket, and Super says to him, "You know that the numbers they have are Arab." And Malik says, "Their numbers are Arab. When like was that recent?" That they came. And it was, God, I don't know. But their letters are definitely theirs. They're not like ours, like the A, B, C, D, or not, and they go this way and we go that way. But their numbers, 1, 2, 3, the way they write them, are ours. And then I said, what do they have before we came? I said, God, I don't know. And so they had this conversation. And I just thought it was a funny idea about Roman numerals versus, you know, the numbers we use. And they both are deeply puzzled and wonder, until recently, did they not have numbers? Or what did they... Anyway, so that's what it was. It was just an attempt to sort of deal with the whole idea. Since each word was being written out, the whole idea of what's behind, you know, the whole idea of... Anyway, yes. But I finished the story. And instead of being 1,334 words, it's now 24,700 words. And it's coming out in a book, you know, at the end of the year or early next year.
I should tell you, the trouble... I went through tracking down every student in my school. It would have been very interesting for you to see the whole process too. Like, it was great integrating the art of your writing along with the work of Micah and then us as an art school all together. So again, thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks for doing it. It was amazing. Yeah. I think I've left everyone speechless. That's great. So is that it? Oh, great. Go.
Are there any plans for The Master as a film?
Somebody did want to do it, and it's a very fickle business, strange. A lot of people want to do things, and they love meeting you for lunch. And then they just, you know, they're attracted by, you know, Hollywood, or, you know. And, you know, so no, not at the moment, but I am... I think I am seriously going to collaborate with an Italian composer called Alberto Caruso, which is a beautiful name for a composer, and we're going to try and do an opera. And I'm going to write the libretto, unless I'm fired from libretto writing. I haven't written a libretto before, but he wants to do it as an actual opera. So it's a question of what to leave out, and we're going to have Henry James as a baritone. And we're going to have Constance Fenimore Wilson as a contralto. And we're going to see where we go then. And Heinrich Andersen will be a tenor. And I have no idea what it'll sound like or look like. Or if it'll ever be really done. But we're talking about it at the moment. And I am going to start working on that at the moment. Yes?
I wonder about depictions of Oscar Wilde either in plays or on the screen. The only one I know of offhand is by Stephen Ray in a Field Day play, if I remember correctly. Do you know anything about that subject?
Yeah. Oh, dear. Here we go. there's a very good play. It's a strange play by Thomas Kilroy, which is about Constance Wilde. Because the figure of Constance Wilde is really heroic. In the way she... I mean, for example, when Oscar Wilde's mother dies, Constance travels back from Switzerland, leaving her two children there. And you can imagine that journey. So that the news will be told to Oscar Wilde by her rather than by anyone in the prison. And she personally tells him. She becomes slightly difficult later because she really, really doesn't understand what has happened. She begins to hate Douglas, and she isn't particularly, well, she doesn't want her children ever to see their father again. And she also has the money. I mean, she's rich. She's rich enough that they have a tussle over what allowance he will get from her private income. But nonetheless, she appears regularly in this story as rather wonderful and heroic. And Thomas Kilroy has a play about her, which I sort of liked. Someone told me there's a good movie with Stephen. Is there a movie with Stephen Fry in it? There's also, I was on a plane recently and I was inflicted with a new version of, the picture of Dorian Gray, which I thought was seriously appalling. I want to travel by road in future. The issue is as follows: as the business of Irish studies has proceeded, that in other words, there was a time when Irish literature was not seen as a coherent body of work, which had to be read in a very different way, say, to English literature. With its own different contours and its own different sort of exemplary figures. But in the last 20 years or 30 years, because of the number of sort of doctorates, the number of just the way this has been done, Irish studies has become an issue. And so it has worked at doing something, for example, with Beckett, the time when Beckett was seen as only a French writer or as mainly a French writer, at really restoring to Beckett not only his Irish roots, but the huge amount of Irish inspiration and the importance of the Irish background to Samuel Beckett. I think this has been very effective and has really worked. It's been very important, rebalancing, you know, how we view Beckett. And obviously, the figure of Oscar Wilde, at the fact that Ireland, in the major work, it's hard to find the word Ireland. But this is all the more reason why it's there. As Borges says, there are no camels mentioned in the Koran. That wasn't because they had no camels. It was because there were camels. It was all camels. And therefore, he didn't need to mention them. And similarly with Wilde, that if you look at the career his father, Sir William, as an antiquarian, as an amateur archaeologist, or as his mother, as a nationalist agitator, and you look at what Wilde was doing in England, that Wilde's Irishness is absolutely fundamental to an understanding of Wilde, and that Wilde becomes an Irish martyr in England of a certain sort. And I'm sort of playing with these ideas here. Now, in the middle of all this, I went to a play, the play that you went to, which is called St. Oscar, which is by Terry Eagleton, where Stephen Ray plays. I went to it in a convent hall in Monaghan. It was touring Ireland, and I just instantly wandered in because I'm interested in the subject. And of course, what I saw fascinated me, because you can get the text. I mean, the text will be in the library. You know, it was so interested in making Oscar Wilde Irish and in upping his Irishness and his martyrdom at the hands of the English, and at sort of examining dramatically that relationship between Ireland and England, that it threw in what I found to be, let's say there was a level of nonchalance about homophobia in the play, that there were phrases, and I remember one in particular that the audience howled with laughter at, and I sat there wondering, was I ever going to get out of this country, and when, or this convent hall indeed. Someone was in rhyming covers, and that Oscar was to bend over for the gentry so they can get their entry. And people were so interested in making him Irish that they forgot that there was another, in a way, minority group involved, you know, in claiming him or wanting him, or at least not wanting to be offended. It's a very hard thing to do if you're running a campaign for something, not to suddenly lose sight of that there are many other people you should be campaigning for too. Do you know what I mean? But if you look at the text, it's a very interesting text, because in claiming him for Ireland, they forgot that there were a whole lot of us in the audience whose maybe sexuality was just as important as their Irishness. Anyway, it's an interesting moment. It was 1980-something, and
I certainly thought I should leave the country and maybe never come back at the time. I mean, it was because I was touring the country with full approval and nobody except me minded.
I loved Brooklyn. I just loved reading it. I wondered what prompted you to write that story.
I think there were, there were three things, I think. One was that I had started, I put it first, it was in a short story, it was in a tiny paragraph, just the story of the book, which I'd heard my mother telling somebody at home. And it was a few sentences, and it was just there. I wrote that in 2000, but in the next 5 years or so, I had gone back and forth to the United States quite a bit, and I had spent, for example, a semester in Austin, Texas, and I'd been a bit homesick. I felt a bit funny about being away, so far away from home, and I missed things, and I was getting those sort of funny feelings about that, and it was on my mind. And the second thing was that I'd been teaching a lot of Jane Austen, and that idea of that the mixture of someone who's sociable and someone who actually realizes most things alone, and that moving back and forth within, especially a powerless person's psyche, between what they can face and what they take alone to the room with them, and how that sort of works. And the third thing was I become, again, in the minority of one, well, maybe minority of two and a half, in Ireland over the issue of immigration. And partly because of the time I had spent in Canada, and you know the way in which even a phrase like New Canadians, or the phrase, just the whole way in which ethnic difference was respected and honoured, and in Ireland suddenly people became afraid of the arrival of Nigerians, Chinese people and Polish people, thought they were taking our jobs from us. It was almost, they were going to take our women from us. But they didn't even, get that far, you know, and so there was a referendum which was to deny rights, any rights, to the children born of foreigners in Ireland. And it was won by an overwhelming majority. And I felt very strange about that. I felt, considering all the places we had gone since the famine, and made ourselves at home, to do this then, the first time we ever had any economic power, was a disgrace, and I felt humiliated by it. And so I was watching all of this, and I was thinking about the Poles, especially at Christmas, and the Chinese New Year, and the way in which they were missing home, and the way in which they were being in Ireland. They were missing Ireland almost, you know, that they didn't go to the Iron Islands, they didn't go to the pubs, they didn't have favourite places, they were merely trying to gain a living, living in cramped quarters, being badly paid, doing work no one else would do. And so that was on my mind as to something that I was watching and seeing. I also have been feeling the emigrant thing, and that story, when I went back to look at it, jumped out at me as being that it was a simple story with three parts. And I was sort of trying to teach creative writing and saying, could you just tell me a story, you know, instead of creating an atmosphere, something just that has a beginning, a middle, a choice, and an end. And so I realized, you know, that if I was teaching myself, I would say, why don't you write that? But I thought it was going to be shorter. You know, in other words, it was only when I had written the first one third, I realized the other two thirds would have to be equal length. But I thought it was going to be maybe 80 pages or 100 pages of a book rather than a full novel. But I carried on working, and that's how it became that. But I mean, I was aware that I was writing something very small, that I was working in pencil, that it wasn't an epic, and that it was one psyche, a very ordinary person, what might happen under those pressures. So that's what I was doing. Yes, I'll just go there and then come to you. Can you turn on the mic? If you shout.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Well, I just think it's really interesting everything you've alluded to about this issue of Irishness and having lived abroad for a long time and sort of commented on Ireland from the outside. What's your relationship now? Like, when you go back, do you feel like something of a foreigner, especially having such different views from the majority of Irish people on a number of issues? Like, where do you feel grounded in your own identity?
I'm completely at home there. I mean, I think that you can always, in any city, find kindred spirits of any sort, you know, even if you have the strangest views, you know, that you find two people will have them too. And also, you can have arguments. I mean, you can hang around with people who don't agree with you. It's a much more relaxed place to be than it used to be, and so much so that, for example, I'm appointed onto the Arts Council by the government, which would have been unthinkable in the past, you know. And even, you know, like the minister had to ring me up and talk to me, and we had a very civil conversation. And I found that interesting, you know, that you should be able to do that with people you disagree with. And also, I spent a lot of time down close to where I was born, you know, in County Wexford. And people don't pay the slightest attention to me other than the fact that I'm my parents' son and my brother's brother. Which of them are you, like, to keep looking at me? Are you that? And then they slowly, oh, you're the writer guy that's up in Dublin, you know. And so it's, in other words, it's easy. And there are times, it's a funny business, there are times if you're flying in, say, from, especially from JFK, and you get into the Irish queue to get on the plane, you realize, oh, God, I'm going home. You know, you realize just the way people look, the way people are getting on the plane. The whole way people, just gestures, some little gesture. I was in St. John. The first time I ever came to Canada was I went to Newfoundland, and I was in St. John's in a bar, and I thought everyone was Irish, because and then I was told, yeah, they're Irish, but they came in the 18th century, but they're Irish, because there was something they were doing that I thought people at home only did, people in Wexford, where I'm from, but a lot of people had gone from that part of southeast of Ireland, Waterford, and had gone out to Newfoundland. Which is in Gaelic is called Talavaniask, the land of the fish is the name for it in Gaelic. But there's something you do at home, which is that if you're in a bar and there's a door there and you're here, and someone comes in, and what you do is you go. Because you don't want to look directly in case you don't like them. You know, because you mightn't like somebody, you wouldn't want to, like, you know. And so, but everyone in the bar did that all night, and I kept saying, but I mean, where did they learn to do, how come, anyway. So I'm talking about, like, with that sort of thing, if you saw someone in JFK getting on the plane doing that for a second, you think, I'm home. Like, I'm home. I know where I'm from. I'm from there. So. Sorry.
So I was just going to make a little your remark about that she's just an ordinary person. My mother's 95, and I gave her Brooklyn. I tried to keep it so she won't complain about herself. And I told her, Mom, you must read this. It's a wonderful book. So the next morning, she stayed up all night, read it. The next morning, she said to me, I don't understand it, Sylvia. She's just an ordinary person.
Yeah, I was interested in say, a figure like Fanny in Mansfield Park, or those sort of figures in Jane Austen who seem so powerless and are seen by everyone else like to be sort of nobodies, and yet you build up this sympathy with them in a book and so yeah. Something like that.
Well, I just thought I'd share with you a 95-year-old observation.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, okay.
You alluded there, Cullum, to the referendum where children of foreign nationals born on the island of Ireland were denied citizenship. And it really did, obviously, as you mentioned, it shocked a certain segment of the community in Ireland, but obviously the majority didn't find it thus. How did you rationalise that, or what is it within Irish people that can cause that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think that that you have to examine this very closely and be careful with it. Referenda are very, very hard things to, you were finding in the same months that if a Nigerian family had their children in a school and everyone got used to the family, they were living next door to them, and got used to the children being friends of their children, and suddenly the court said this family has to be deported back to Nigeria where they belong, the school would go into uproar. The parents would have a meeting. They would go to the minister. They'd do everything possible to keep this Nigerian family in the community. The same people who, if you ask them another question, being, do you think, you know, if you ask them the theoretical question, would say no. If you ask them the actual practical question, would say, yeah, we know them. We like them. So that it was that business of the disconnection between public debate and private feelings that actually could have given you a view, maybe, that Irish people were really, really how would you put it, xenophobic. And but actually on the ground it wasn't like that when people were there. But also, I didn't think there was any great leadership given by the state in any of the state's institutions that set up systems whereby it was absolutely clear that outsiders, so to speak, were welcome in Ireland. So that from government, from any agency within government, from even the arts community, you know, from any area, to say, actually, we need you, we want you, we love you, and we're going to create a new society for you. That simply wasn't being done from the top. And then to expect people who had come from a country where they'd only known insularity, you know, an island where people left, the idea somehow of people coming in was so new. Ireland is not a country, unlike North America, made up of outsiders arriving and making home. It isn't a country made up of that, so that it simply didn't know what to do under those conditions. I mean, I think if you did such a referendum in Italy about Albanians, I wouldn't like to think what number would vote. You know, in other words, it was a problem that Europe developed. I mean, if you look at the way even the Germans wouldn't give the Turkish people born in Germany the vote in Germany until recently. But it isn't as though it was a particularly Irish problem. I have to say that one of the only thing, with certain blips, the city of London is, or even Yorkshire, is remarkable in this respect at how much, but that's obviously the whole history of the empire is bound up with this. But the way in which the city of London has now become a place where everyone eats one another's food. I mean, they pay for it, but I mean, in which the idea of getting roast beef and Yorkshire pudding has just died out. And that has made its way into the fundamentals of the way the society is run now in England. I mean, with odd blips and odd moments where it was. So it's just a question of the suddenness of it. But I just presumed it would go the other way. I just innocently presumed that Ireland would know what to do under those conditions. But it actually didn't. And
I'm going voting for it. Yeah, they should be allowed. And then in the privacy of the booth, because that's what we've had in the country for the last 30 years, people on the one hand say, oh, Jesus, we're not going to vote for them again. And then we give them three terms in a row, or whatever it may be.
Yeah, but there was
there's
no,
the public
yeah.
persona and there's the private persona.
Yeah, but I mean, there was no huge demand for this referendum. It was put up by a politician. I'm glad to see that he was later run out of public life. But it's actually on a personal level, oddly enough, I mean, Ireland being such a funny little place, this politician who, you know, we both, obviously, I can take from your tone, despise, and enjoyed the fact that he was run out of public life, on a personal level, he's actually quite a nice guy. I actually like him. You know, and that's the sort of funny business, too, how much, if you live beside someone for long enough, you think, yeah, I disagree with every word he says, and I hope he's run out of the place, but actually, he's okay, you know. So it's a funny... I wish it was simpler, you know, but it was all caused by a politician looking to establish his toughness in the face of, you know, weak liberals like ourselves. Yeah, sorry.
If I can bring you back a moment to Oscar Wilde, I happen to know whether he was condemned just on what he wrote or whether on trial. There were a number of his lovers or people speaking clearly of sexual happenings between him and them.
Yeah. I mean, I think this was why W.B. Yeats' father sent Yeats around, in that what Wilde was up to was a fundamental part of London society or Victorian society in London. And it was a sort of secret underworld of the city. And I also think that the government and people in power really did leave it for a while too. I mean, if he had caught that train in those last days to the boat, they would have let him go to France. So that, you see, what he did was he brought the case against the Marquess of Queensberry for sending that postcard posing as a sodomite. Everyone told him not to. In that case, the last thing he realized was that he had been so careless that he had written letters and that he'd done all sorts of things, including, of course, places where he'd stayed with Lord Alfred Douglas the staff had examined the sheets afterwards. And so suddenly, the Marquess of Queensberry's lawyers were able to amass a huge amount of evidence that Oscar Wilde had been not only flouting decency in his work, which everyone loved the idea of and laughed a lot at, but it actually had been doing it. And and therefore, the libel action fell apart, and he waited, and everyone presumed he would just go. That's what France is for. And of course, he would have done perfectly well in Paris. He would have been the toast of Paris, English hypocrisy, Victorian hypocrisy. He would have got on with his work. His wife and children would have come with him, and it would have been all fine. But he stayed, and my interest in him staying is that it wasn't exactly looking for martyrdom, that he almost went. And there's a thing I didn't put in there, that there was a moment when he has no money at this point. So that there's a hotel bill that he hasn't paid, and the hotel staff are watching him all the time in case he does a runner without paying his bill. And so that there are moments in it where it could have been otherwise. And so he waits and waits and waits, and eventually he's sentenced. But a number of the young men with whom he had consorted had letters to prove it or had evidence to give. And the one moment that really turned things was when Wilde is in the witness box and is asked by the lawyer, did you sleep with, Johnny Smith? And he said, oh, no, he's far too ugly for that. And he thought the audience would laugh. The audience remained. He lost them. They didn't think that was funny. For a second, the performance had failed. And from that moment onwards, everybody said they were dead against him. The flippancy. He was talking about a boy they were all looking at in the court. And so it turned. And he was also, of course, examined by the best prosecuting lawyer around. It was Edward Carson, who would, of course, later lead the Ulster Unionists in the creation of partition in Ireland. In other words, he was dealing with a very, very formidable figure.
Your account raises some fundamental questions about accepted wisdom, namely the question of cleverness, friendship, love, and more particularly the matter of the relationship between suffering and spirituality and the redemptive power of art. It seems to me that your narrative puts into question all of these almost sacred tenets of human culture and intellectual endeavors. So could you, I know it's a big question, but could you perhaps say something that about the matter of reconsideration of all of these things that we take for granted?
Yeah, it's. He does raise these questions because he was the funniest man in London who slowly became the saddest. And there's almost nobody else in that position who. And also the distance between the prisoner class and the class of people like Wilde, and also what happens to somebody under those pressures, who up to then is writing these gloriously funny, beautifully constructed, fluffy works of art. What would happen to the human spirit if you actually have them tied to a treadmill all day and where they can't sleep and they have diarrhea all the time? What 2 years of that darkness, solitude, and isolation? Also, he couldn't speak. He wasn't allowed to speak to anybody. He was alone in his cell, and for the 1 hour a day, he couldn't speak. So it was utter solitary confinement. His confinement does show us, in a way we don't have equal evidence, simply because there's no other writer who goes through that, that is as well charted and documented in the before and after. So, yes, it does raise absolutely fundamental questions over ideas of sincerity or authenticity, what suffering does to the spirit, flippancy versus seriousness, and what happens to the personality under certain pressures. So he is extremely interesting in that respect. But I'm not sure that we learned anything that we couldn't have guessed about that from him. Do you think we could, that there is, when you said that it was unexpected or turning it or reversing it?
Well, you seem to suggest that, and I think you made a statement, that certain kinds of cleverness seem to carry within themselves this power of imminence that brings about a certain downfall. And so I wasn't sure if it was just a matter of cleverness or whether you were talking about the creative spirit in general, that there is a negative side to creativity that can be misused or backfire. And my other question would then be, what would your advice, based on the work you've done with Wilde as a case study, what would your advice be to other people in similar circumstances that are, should they risk their reputations and their lives on the basis of social cause, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I get what you're good. I think there is another narrative here, which is something we might call the art of being found out or the need to be found out. That if you were living in these years at the end of the Victorian regime, where you were meant to be, as Yeats describes you, a happily married man living in white rooms with these beautiful children, and you were doing the other thing as well, that you somehow develop a desperate need for yourself to be known, and that makes its way into what a certain doctor in Vienna will slowly begin to formulate, which will affect our lives so deeply, the idea that the secret hidden self must appear or it will boil over and cause only damage to the psyche and the self. And that if you want to ask, why did Wilde sue the Marquess of Queensberry? One reason, as I'm saying, is that he suddenly became somebody else. He became this indignant son of Sir William Wilde. But the other one is, of course, that he desperately, in some secret cavern of himself, needed for who he was to be known. And the price he paid was enormous for that. But that has really been the sort of narrative of the last 100 years. I mean, I was recently going over when Stalin heard first about psychoanalysis, you know, when Freudian ideas were really developing and spreading, and they told him what it was, that he may or may not have said, I mean, it's unclear really, but he may have said, this will do more damage to the West, the business of letting everything be known, of not keeping things in, than any number of bombs we could make or things we could do. That you know, the business of the shrink, the couch, the psychoanalysis is really the most, it's the thing that has weakened the West. That our economy, the fact that the Chinese economy is so strong and ours are getting so weak, is that they are still holding everything in and they never tell anyone what they're thinking. We spend all our time thinking that we not only we should, but we must. And that really has been the narrative of the last 100 years, and then Wilde is there at the beginning of it. But I'm not sure we can ever put the genie back in the bottle. I don't think anyone wants to. We just keep borrowing money from the Chinese.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a rigorous.